going back to the spring, the board and the worship guild and other folks decided it might be a good thing to call our first Sunday back together in the fall homecoming for a change, because that's kind of what we are. Start a new worship year with a bang, so to speak, and invite some people who haven't been around for a while, for whatever reasons. And I want to tell you, I talked to a couple of those folks, and they didn't come here today, but they might be for too long. You know, so, you know, you got to open the door, and then they got to kind of, you know, sniff around a little bit and so forth. So just if everybody didn't come today, keep doing some good work. They might be around before you know it. And it's also an opportunity for all of us to take a new look at the Unitarian Church in Staten Island, to use new eyes to see what's being done now and what needs to be done. The physical plan, for instance. As many of you know, we've put a lot of work into the parsonage on the last couple of years, and it's in better shape than it's been a long time. Now we just got to figure out what to do with it. And we're getting close. They're kind of creeping up on that decision, too. We hope to be able to get maybe one more year out of our ancient and venerable heating system, because we find it's very difficult to put a 21st century heating plan into a 19th century building. There's a lot of stuff to figure out, you know, not the least of which is how do we heat this sanctuary and preserve its historic nature, preserve the sanctuary feeling that we have. So we're working on that. And we hope to get the floors polished and redone in the parish hall, and the bathrooms fixed, and we're working with Project Hospitality on that. But as we said, Terry's had quite a setback on that. So in the fullness of time, I think, is the biblical phrase for all these things we want to be doing. But anyhow, it's about appreciating and living within our historic buildings, not only for us, but as a community trust. And the reason why we should preserve these buildings, assuming that we do, goes back to our history. I communicated in the spring both with the outstanding Unitarian historian and the outstanding Universalist historian. And both of them agreed with me that this may just very be the only Unitarian church that was intentionally founded with a significant number of abolitionists in 1852. Now, one of the reasons that was is not that many Unitarian churches were being formed in 1852. They tended to be much older than that and going forward, and they didn't really start developing a lot of new churches until there was more of a Western migration after the Civil War. But this was founded by folks coming down from the Boston area. And now, I've studied the Civil War gone back quite a bit recently, because being here and hearing about the abolitionists who helped found this church got me curious about another number of things in American history, and again, how that time impacts on our time today. And I realized that being an abolitionist in 1852 was a big risk. I don't know, maybe 10, 15% of the population might have been abolitionist at the time. You know, when I grew up in Ohio, and perhaps you did too, I sort of thought that during the Civil War, everybody up north were against slavery, and everybody in the South was for slavery. And now I found that ain't true in either case. And it especially wasn't true up north. A lot of people in the North, even if they said slavery's bad, they felt it was a necessary, if peculiar, institution to keep its engines rolling. And not everybody in the South was for slavery either. Now, I realize that forming a congregation with a significant number of abolitionists in 1852, probably one of the reasons why the church wasn't any bigger than it was. You know, they'd come here and Francis George Shaw would go into his thing about how blacks are equal human beings and most of the people just turn on their heels and walk away. Also, you know, we didn't really have any renowned ministers during that time either. And then I realized that declaring yourself an abolitionist in the 1850s was not a good career move for a Unitarian minister. It significantly decreased your employment opportunities. Now, Henry Whitney Bellows was the minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Manhattan, the first and largest Unitarian church in Manhattan. And he was did a lot with the institutions of Unitarianism to forward it and help it grow. And he also, as most of the ministers of large Unitarian churches did at the time, recommended to his congregation that they obey the fugitive slave law, because after all, it was the law of the land. Now, in the 1850s, the abolition movement itself was making a big transition. It started out with William Lloyd Garrison and the Liberator back in the 1830s with an appeal to people's soul, that it's bad for the soul to have slavery. It's bad in the eyes of God to have slavery. And he attracted a small number of followers who almost immediately split. And you know what issue they split over? Whether women should be allowed to speak in publicly against slavery. The American Abolitionist Society went with Garrison, and he said, yes, women can speak. And the society in which women were not allowed to speak was called the Massachusetts Abolitionist Society. So when you think about being an abolitionist, sure, I would have been an abolitionist in the 1840s and 1850s. Well, you would have been in a very small minority. And then you'd have to decide whether you wanted women to speak in your cause or not. But after a while, the spiritual abolition evolved into what's called an ethical abolition. And this is where a lot of Unitarians came on board, especially William Ellery Channing up in Boston, who was the number one voice of Unitarianism at the time. And I spoke about this in the spring. Channing and a lot of the moderate Unitarians always complained that the abolitionists spoke crudely about their cause. And finally one of them said, well, if somebody eloquent like you would speak for abolition, then you wouldn't have that argument anymore, would you? And you know, it actually, from that time on, William Ellery Channing used his eloquence to speak in favor of abolition. He became an ethical abolitionist, that slavery was not good for society. Now, by the 1850s, it had moved into the third phase, which was political abolition. We needed to change the laws. And those original abolitionists were not all that on board with political abolition, because they felt that it was possible to change the laws without changing the hearts of the people. And I think they made a pretty good point. But then Harper's Ferry happened, and somebody down there committed an act of civil disobedience, and for that they didn't hang him, or they didn't send him to jail, they hanged him. But that really kind of fomented the trend toward political abolition. In 1856, the Republican Party, the new Republican Party, nominated John C. Fremont to be president of the United States. And during the time he ran for president, you know where he lived? About 9th Street in Staten Island. Why? Because he was being bankrolled by the abolitionists in this church. Now, he didn't get elected. Why? Well, he was just a little too radical, and the country wasn't quite ready for it. And he was beaten by James Buchanan, one of the most charismatically challenged presidents in the history of the Republic. But also during that time, if you want to find the historical antecedents of Donald Trump, go on your computers and Google Know Nothing Party. Now, Fremont was too radical in 1856, so the Republicans nominated a more moderate candidate who was opposed to slavery, but was by no means an abolitionist, and he was from the Midwest, so he could undercut a lot of the Copperhead votes, those Democrats who were still for slavery. And they nominated this obscure legislator named Lincoln, and he got elected. And you know, they always say, well, but he didn't get a majority of the vote. You know, he got a plurality, but he didn't get a majority. But you know what? He wasn't even on the ballot in a lot of what became the Confederate states. I didn't know that until last week. You know, he's recorded as not having a single vote in Alabama and places like that. But Francis George Shaw was, again, very instrumental in the financing of Abraham Lincoln's run for the presidency. You can think of him as being to Lincoln what the Koch brothers are to Ted Cruz. And William George Shaw's family and descendants helped build these walls and sat in this area and helped bring compassion and social justice to Staten Island and New York City for many, many generations after that. Now, nationally, a lot of abolitionists were Unitarians, but not a lot of Unitarians were abolitionists. Got that? Now, Theodore Parker, the guy who wrote The Arc of History is Long But It Bends Toward Justice, he was a Unitarian, threw off a phrase called of the people, by the people, and for the people that got picked up. Those abolitionist Unitarians were in constant conflict with the majority of Unitarians. And now, in Unitarian Universalist history, Theodore Parker's everywhere. Nobody knows Henry Whitney Bellows. But it's hard to find a minister of those largest churches back then that didn't believe it wasn't quite time and that they needed to obey the laws, keep our economy growing. Now, fast forward to the civil rights movement in the 1960s. In the 1960s, a lot of white civil rights activists were Unitarians, but not a lot of Unitarians were civil rights activists. If you saw the movie Selma, Viola Liuzzo and James Reeb, the two murders that were depicted in that movie, were both Unitarians. I wish they would have got a shout out that they were Unitarians. I wish they would have mentioned that in Glory, that Robert Gould Shaw came from Unitarian. But there were vast numbers relative to the white population who were Unitarians at that march in Selma. Absolutely. Lay ministers, lay people, and ministers both. And they should be remembered. But what we also have to remember, and have to remember really right now, I think, is what happened in the years right afterwards, which if you Google Black Empowerment Tragedy, you'll get a very interesting article by a Black Unitarian Universalist minister named Mark Morrison Reed. It happened in 1967 and continued on for several years after that. Because Unitarians had such a presence at Selma and in the civil rights movement relative to other white churches, in the years after that, Unitarian churches, Unitarian Universalist churches, received a relatively large infusion of African American members. And by 1967, a group of African American Unitarian Universalists went to the General Assembly and demanded $1 million for projects that they alone would choose and administrate. That was about 12% of the UUA operating budget at the time. And the response of the General Assembly was, what? To say the least, this demand inspired a lot of discussion over the next few years. Actually, it was almost a schism. You might have even called it a schism between those who wanted to empower the black-only group and those who didn't. It's Unitarian Universalists had been so committed to integration for so long that they didn't really know how to deal with black power. Now, what finally emerged after a lot of heat and pain was a splinter group being given a splinter amount of money, which actually one of the things that resulted from that was the PBS documentary, Eyes on the Prize. If you saw that, probably the single greatest film documentary of the civil rights movement came out of that movement. And you wondered, geez, if we'd only given $1 million, I wonder what they would have done with it. No. There was terrible hurt and pain associated with that movement. Many of the black folks that joined the Unitarian Universalist Association after Selma left after the black empowerment tragedy, as did a number of whites who supported the black empowerment. And really nothing much happened in the UUA, in the area of racial justice, for over 20 years until a baby boomer became president of the UUA, Bill Shultz, in 1985. And he started a program called anti-racism. If you remember that at the time, there was a lot of blowback because anti-racism, that's negative. We want to be for something. I'm going, oh, are you really going to fight about that? Yeah. So that's why I was kind of surprised at the Unitarian General Assembly this year passing a resolution of immediate witness, which I will quote from in part. We must continue to support the Black Lives Matter movement and black-led racial justice organizations. Be it further resolved that the 2015 General Assembly recognizes that the fight for civil rights and equality is as real today as it was decades ago, and urges member congregations to take initiative in collaboration with local and national organizations fighting for racial justice against the harsh racist practices to which many black people are exposed. Gee, I was surprised. That's more guts and direction than I've seen out of a General Assembly resolution in a good long time. And then, you know where it came from? Came from the Youth Caucus. That's what the millennials are saying to you. That's where the Occupy movement came from. So this time, I'm asking in the name of God and Theodore Parker, let's not screw it up. Let's not divide ourselves over tactics and procedure and rhetoric, but let's stay united in truth and begin again in love. When the Unitarian Church of Staten Island has a homecoming, it means coming home to a legacy of seeking justice and equality. It is not something we have to change to do. It's just something we have to do to be true to our history. And I don't want to get hung up on the meaning of Black Lives Matter. To me, even arguing about it is a distraction from the real task of transformative and restorative justice that lies ahead. It's simply a matter of taking what we say we believe in here out into the community. The last board meeting, we discussed the possibility of having a wider board a wider book discussion on the book The New Jim Crow. I know some of you discussed that a few years ago. I'm all for that. The New Jim Crow is the book that really sort of pieces together all the disparate aspects that come together that helps us show that the racist legacy of 150 years ago was repeated beginning with Nixon's Southern Strategy. I've reached out to some black clerical leaders to find ways that we can collaborate and be on board with what they plan. And if you are in touch with African American religious leaders, or the rabbi that you mentioned too, have them get in touch with me. Let's see what we can do together. You may have some ideas as well. You may also have some fear and trepidation. To me, this means you are sane and rational. The idea is that within a supportive community, we can, as LBJ said when he signed the legislation and kissed off the Southern support for a generation, we shall overcome. We shall overcome our white fear and trepidation, and in concert with others, overcome our legacy of inequality and injustice. After all, any church or synagogue or mosque is free to put out a banner that says Black Lives Matter. I encourage them to do so. But there's only one congregation in Staten Island that can put out a sign that says, working for equality since 1852.